The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in our meditation and mindfulness practice, we often give instructions and explore the inner world of our experience. And this is really helpful for us. As I think most of you know, it helps us to kind of enter into the lived experience of our lives. It begins to reveal to us ways that we contract and ways that we feel more open and expansive. And we begin to recognize that those contractions, often based in greed, aversion, delusion, don't serve us in our spiritual life as we, I think most of us are in this practice to kind of find ways to be happier, more at ease, have a greater sense of well-being. And we begin to see through this inner exploration the ways that our own minds and bodies kind of aren't serving us. The awareness of how our minds and bodies aren't serving us helps to turn the tide. That as we become aware of how our minds contract and get tight and tense around experience or situations, we begin to recognize there's another way that we can begin to not contract. And it's not necessarily something we do, but the very having the contractions into consciousness begins to help the mind understand how to let go, how to reorient, how to move towards more of a sense of well-being. And so this inner practice is a beautiful one for us. And we talk about it a lot here. And the Buddha also talked about not only this inner world of practice, but also practice in relationship, practice in community, practice in the outer realm of our lives. And so I wanted to kind of explore that side of it a little bit and then also talk a little bit about a teaching where the Buddha kind of had us alternating inner and outer, and to see how that can be a very deep practice for us to support our seeing the ways that we get caught and confused in our lives. So some of the kind of familiar ways, perhaps, that the Buddha talked about outer practice. I mean, one of the most familiar is the practice of dana, of giving. The practice of offering. Sometimes material things. Sometimes of ourselves, of our time, of our presence. This practice of giving, that the word, the Pali word dana means giving. It's often, people say that dana means generosity, but there's a kind of a distinction that the Pali word dana is for the action of giving. And the distinction is that we can act that with that, with giving and still be working on the inner quality of generosity. So the practice of giving is said to be one of the conditions that help to support and generate this feeling, the inner feeling of generosity. And so this is another way the inner and outer connect here, that we make the action, we cultivate the action of giving, maybe motivated already by an inner sense of generosity, that motivates that action. And also we can cultivate the act of giving with an intentional purpose of deepening in that quality or that experience, that quality of a generous heart. So generosity is on the path of practice, partly understood to help us begin to recognize that when we have the sense of me, mine, don't want to give away, a sense of stinginess, a sense of fear around letting go, that all of those are, again, in the inner landscape, we see that those are contractions, that they are tightening. There's a sense of, when we actually pay attention to those experiences, we can tell they're not leading us towards a deeper kind of happiness. They may be leading us towards a kind of momentary, this is mine, I get to keep it. And there could be some kind of happiness there. But when we actually pay attention to how it feels, that this is mine, 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 it feels tight, it feels hard, it feels bounded. And as we cultivate the quality of generosity through the act of giving, we begin to see the, at times perhaps, not necessarily immediately, but at times we might begin to see the joy that goes with giving. The seeing the joy in someone else as they receive something that we've offered. The joy of supporting someone with your presence. So this, we begin to see that the quality of generosity, the inner quality of generosity, has more of an open feeling. It has more of a expansive feeling. So we, in this practice or act of cultivating this quality of generosity through the act of dana, of giving, we begin to, again, see the inner and outer, the impact it has on others, and the impact it has on ourselves. Another key way that the Buddha talked about inner and outer, the outer realm of practice, is through the practice of ethics. And this is often, I think, when we think of ethics, perhaps that might translate into morality or right, wrong, something like that. The word ethics is a little more neutral for us. It tends to be a little more neutral. The word ethical can land for us in a kind of a more easeful way than right, wrong, morality. I don't know. Just for me, the word ethical seems to have a little bit of an easier landing for me. And in the Buddhist teachings, he did talk about the ethical practices associated with the precepts, refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, refraining from intoxicants, all of which he encourages to engage in. Refrain from, actually, they're all stated in terms of refraining from, through our actions of body, again, to help cultivate an inner quality of non-harming. The ethics in the Buddhist practice, the precepts, are rooted in this wish for non-harming. And if we think about the whole purpose, in a way, of the Buddhist path, which is leading towards freedom from suffering, stress, struggle. It makes sense that the Buddha encouraged us to not harm others, to not create stress, struggle, suffering in our actions with others. Because if it's a path towards inner freedom from stress, suffering, it makes sense to not engage in outer ways that create it in others. And the Buddha's, recollection or reflection on this is, again, that it's not just that engaging in non-harming with others is just for others, because as we refrain from taking actions that harm others, we benefit. We benefit by not feeling remorse, regret. We benefit by not feeling the contraction that often comes with actions that harm others. Often when we look at it, actions that create harm in the world are motivated out of contraction, out of tightness, of resistance, of confusion, of anger, of greed. All of those having that kind of tightening quality. And so the Buddha encouraged us in these precepts, saying, look, these actions, refraining from these actions, if you engage in taking life and taking what's not given, in sexual misconduct and false speech, in particular those, the fifth precept around intoxicants is a little different quality to it. The precept there is encouraging us to cultivate clarity of mind, and intoxicants tend to cloud the perception of our mind. But in terms of refraining from these first four, you know, if we're acting in ways that are harming others in that way, it's almost always motivated, especially if it's intentional. If it's not intentional, I mean, we can, for instance, walk across the lawn and step on a spider and not know we've stepped on a spider, having killed that being. There's no intention to have killed that being. In fact, we didn't even know the being was there. And so that is not understood so much as breaking the precept or engaging in a harmful way. It's sad that happened, and if we find out later that happened, we might feel a sadness for the suffering that happened. When we engage intentionally in these kinds of actions, I think you'll find that there's that inner contraction. And again, that inner contraction is a kind of suffering in our own being, not leading us towards connectivity, not leading us towards expansiveness, open-heartedness, ease, peace in our hearts. I mean, even just contemplate or reflect on how it is if you tell a lie to somebody, you know, lie to a friend, even if it's a small thing, you know, just a small thing, like, you know, not wanting to tell somebody that you're going out with somebody else and they're not invited. You know, you might say, oh, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm not available today, or, you know, I can't do anything today, or something. We might just say in some way, I mean, not available today actually wouldn't be a lie, but just, you know, in some ways I think we often kind of construct little white lies to try to protect people. And, you know, even that kind of thing, you know, there's a sense of connection. There's a sense of not wanting to hurt the other person, which is beautiful. And yet what often happens, you know, when we've said that kind of a thing, is that our minds kind of get contracted. You know, the next time we're with that person, we have to remember, oh, I can't talk about that thing that I did with that other person because I told her I wasn't going to be there, or I wasn't around. So, you know, we have a kind of an agitated quality to our minds that happen even around small kinds of these actions. And so this engaging in the outer world of the precepts, you know, how we act with our fellow beings, cultivates an inner releasing, an inner... it's said to that living a life by the precepts gives us the bliss of blamelessness, which is a beautiful kind of quality. Now, the ethics, I think, goes deeper than just the precepts. In fact, ethics in Buddhist psychology can really be looked at as skillful and unskillfulness with respect to freeing our hearts and minds from this very contraction. And so the question of ethics actually goes quite deep. And it's not simply about how we engage in the world, but it is about what supports us in our inner landscape, to free our hearts and minds from this contraction. And I'll come back to that. A couple of other ways that the practice of the outer is explored in the teachings. One is the practice of the Brahmaviharas, the qualities of kindness, of love, of loving kindness, of compassion, of sympathetic joy, and of equanimity. This is encouraged in our relationships with others to actively cultivate these qualities of heart. There are whole practices around this, bringing people into our minds and actively wishing them goodwill. May you be happy. May you be healthy. Again, opening our hearts and seeing this practice again, seeing where we are contracted. You know, we're not expected in this practice of exploring this connection of the Brahmaviharas, of these four qualities of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. We're not expected to be able to automatically be able to have this boundless feeling of love for everybody in the world. But our practice is to recognize where we get caught, where we get stuck. That's the very place for our exploration. And we might find, surprisingly, in this practice of loving kindness, that, you know, with dear friends, that we, yes, we wish them well, and yet it comes up against some kind of rub, you know, as we're reflecting on, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe. It's like, wow, but they did that thing. Why did they do that thing? And it gets in the way of that wish. And so that recognition of that contraction that happens, that's part of our exploration. It's not outside of the exploration of the cultivation of these qualities. In fact, the practice kind of goes back and forth. We wish those, we make those wishes, and we see where we're tight. We acknowledge that. We acknowledge our tightness there. Again, the recognition, bringing that into our awareness. If it weren't in our awareness, it would be you know, motivating those little kind of, you know, things we say to people sometimes that we just have a little bit of a sting to them, you know, just this tiny thing. You know, often those kinds of things are motivated when we're not so conscious of our contractions in relationship. And so bringing the consciousness to it helps us to recognize, oh, maybe I don't want to act on that contraction. So I'm making the whirlwind tour through all these things. I could do a whole, you know, weeks on these. But I just want to kind of lay the territory, because when I was thinking about it, it's like, wow, there's a lot there the Buddha talked about in terms of the outer realm of practice, and how our relationships can really be a domain of practice. The fourth area I thought of, so generosity or giving, ethics, practices of loving kindness. The fourth area I thought of, or loving kindness, the Brahmaviharas, including all four of the Brahmaviharas. The fourth area I thought of was it's not so much taught in our the Western world. We do bring it in from time to time, and this is the practice of offering merit. We bring it in often at the end of like a day long or at the end of a retreat. We will express the wish, may our practice be of benefit to others. So this is actually a practice, this exploration of wishing that how we are engaged be of benefit to others. It kind of turns our minds in a way to, you know, that inner world, that inner work that we're doing, that it's not just about us. You know, sometimes, you sit and meditate and then go out into the world. If there's not that sense of, may this be of service, may this be of benefit to others, you know, sometimes it's maybe just like, the term navel gazing, you know. It's not connecting us to the world. But this very simple practice of merit, of recognizing, yes, this work that I do inwardly can be of service to others. There's a sutta, a teaching story about two acrobats. There's a master acrobat and his apprentice. And the master acrobat says something like, you look out for me, and I'll look out for you, and that way we'll come down safely from our bamboo pole. You know, you envision, you know, this bamboo pole being suspended, and they're doing some kind of tricks up on the bamboo pole. And the acrobat said, Master, I think actually it works a little differently. I'll look out for myself, and you look out for yourself, and that way we'll come down safely. And the Buddha, in responding to this teaching story, first said the apprentice acrobat was right, that in looking out for ourselves, we end up looking out for others. And that he tied this to the practice of mindfulness, the practice of being aware of our inner landscape, aware of the contractions, aware of the times we feel more expansive, we see how that impacts the world. And we start to appreciate the expansive and wish to let go of the contracted. So the looking out for ourselves, and we see, again, you know, kind of back to the ethics, we see that when we are looking out for ourselves, not acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion actually feels better in our system, and it has the impact of taking care of others. So this notion of offering merit is actively acknowledging the possibility that how we are in the world supports others. I'm going to keep going for a little bit. So this back and forth, and the Buddha for this teaching story also then said, and the master was right. Looking out for others, we end up looking out for ourselves. That the taking care of others supports our inner life, our inner non-contraction. And he related that, I think, both to the practice of ethics and to the practice of the Brahmaviharas. So.
Oh, I was just laughing. Whenever they're on airlines, they always say if there's an emergency loss of air, you're always supposed to put your oxygen mask
on first. Your own oxygen mask on first.
Before you put the oxygen mask on your child.
That's a beautiful example of taking care of yourself first. I mean, if you you might pass out while you're putting the oxygen mask on your child or something, you know. So that's a good example of that, taking care of yourself first. and then taking care of others. So this practice of merit, I mean, it's actually beautiful to remind ourselves, you know, getting up from a sitting, you know, the benefit of this practice of noticing my heart and mind and how I am in the moment, may it serve, may it be of benefit to others. It connects us outwardly to do that. Then the piece that I wanted to explore in a little bit more detail was one teaching that is around, you know, it could be looked at as around a teaching on ethics, but it goes so deep, this teaching. And it is, again, it's this inner and outer. It's looking at the inner and outer. So the teaching is one that he gave to his son, when his son was 7 years old. And it's a teaching that a seven-year-old can understand, and yet it has very profound impacts for how we engage in the world. There's a kind of a little backstory. Apparently, Rahula, his son, had told a lie that day or something, and so the Buddha is kind of wanting to explore this question of ethical conduct with him. And he gives a number of similes for how somebody who tells a lie is throwing away a lot of the good that they have in their lives. And then he brings up an analogy of a mirror. He said, "What's a mirror for?" And his son says, "It's for reflection." And the Buddha said, "So likewise, you should reflect repeatedly about your actions." And he goes on to say, before you engage in any action of body, of speech, or of mind, and I'll cover those three in just a moment. Before you engage in any action of body, speech, or mind, you should reflect. Will this cause affliction for myself, for the other, or for both? And if it would, if you see on reflection that it would cause affliction, refrain from doing that action. And he goes on. He says, while you're doing an action of body, of speech, or of mind, if you're seeing that it is causing affliction for self or other, or both, you should stop doing that action. And he goes on, after you have engaged in an action of body, speech, or mind, you should reflect, has this caused harm for self or other or both? Or affliction. The word is affliction, which I think in some ways, I looked up the Pali last night for this word, and one person described or translated this term as disturbance of the peace. So it's more subtle than actively causing harm, I think. You know, it includes that, but it comes to a subtler sense of you know, affliction, of agitation, of so it could go very deep in terms of this reflection. Is this action going to cause a disturbance of the peace? That's pretty broad, and I'll have to set some context to that in a moment. So after you've engaged in the action, has it caused affliction to self or other or both? And if it has, you should, the text says something like you should lay that action open to someone wise and make the effort not to engage in that action again. It doesn't actually say try to make amends with the person. And I think that's interesting. I'll get to that. We'll see how far we can get with this, but that may be something I can talk about in a little while. So the first piece about this story, one is that he's encouraging repeated reflection on our actions and how they impact us and others. So it's really this inner-outer thing. It is this inner and outer thing. So that we're not just looking at how it impacts me, but also kind of aware in the world of how, when we're moving through the world, how do our actions impact other people? So this reflection, I think a couple pieces about this reflection. We see through reflection. I mean, it takes honesty, it takes the willing to be open. This isn't like reflect and beat yourself up. If you see that harm has been caused or affliction has been caused, it's much more about how can I learn from this? I think that's the whole emphasis here, is learning from our actions, learning from our mistakes, essentially. This whole teaching can be understood as a way that we can become our own teacher by observing how we are in the world, how our inner landscape is. Are we feeling affliction? Are others being afflicted? Another piece that I think is really interesting as I was reflecting on this, because it includes mental action. You know, let's think first about body and speech. You know, that to not engage in, to reflect whether actions of body, actions of speech will cause harm, inner or outer. That's kind of more obvious in a way, you know, that we can see how our actions, our physical actions and our speech can directly cause affliction to others as well as ourselves, and to learn from that. But he also brings in the mental component. And I think this is important because in our training, in our exploration of our hearts and minds, we begin to see that our actions of speech and body are often, as I said earlier, kind of motivated by an inner holding, contraction, aversion, anger, confusion. So our inner, our mental Buddha used the word action, the mental actions impact our behavior. And so I think the reason it's brought in is not necessarily that, you know, a thought that arises in my mind may not directly impact. The thought, for instance, is probably not going to have a direct impact on another person. But that thought in the mind might lead to a flitting of expression across your face that is seen and even possibly recognized for what's going on in an inner way. And so this is diving deep for us. So this teaching, I think, goes very deep in terms of looking at, okay, if there's a thought in my mind of anger, that very experience creates contraction. That often, you know, the feeling of a thought of anger is often motivated by a feeling of anger, and that feeling itself is not a happy place to be when we look at it, when we see it with mindfulness. I spent a long time in my life with a lot of anger and was consciously aware that it did impact others. In fact, that was the impact I wanted it to have. You know, I wanted other people to be miserable when I was angry. I thought they deserved to be miserable when I was, you know, for what they had done or whatever. And so I was very conscious of how it impacted others and thought they deserved it. And when I first began paying attention in my experience to, okay, this was my first meditation projects. I want to anger was running my life. It was basically making me non-functional at times. And so that was one of my first spiritual practices. I want to know when I'm angry. I want to be aware of that. And one of my early insights was, wow, this doesn't feel very good. I had no idea, you know, until I really started practicing I wasn't conscious of the fact that that quality of anger had such an impact on my own heart and mind. So this teaching around recognizing action of body, speech, and mind really indicates the depth of how the Buddha explored this outer relationship. It's not just about our actions, it's also about the inner motivation for our actions, to be cognizant of that, to be cognizant of that inner motivation. And being cognizant of it, again, not to beat ourselves up about it or to repress that, but to be aware of it brings the opportunity for choice in our lives. Potentially, if we can see, sometimes I do this kind of almost a game, you know, it's like, okay, I'm feeling impatience right now. Let me see if I cannot let that leak out into my body. So to not repress the impatience, to not repress that mental quality inside, but also to see if I didn't have to let it reverberate through the physicality of my body into my actions. And in exploring that, I've seen it's actually quite interesting how not allowing that mental quality to be expressed physically, the mental quality is like, it's like it's not reinforced. It's amazing how much just subtle actions of body end up reinforcing the inner mind states. And in that practice around impatience, like I've seen, yeah, okay, let me not let that leak out into my body. And the mind state changed pretty quickly. Within a minute, the mind was much more relaxed, at ease. So this body, speech, and mind piece, I think, is an important piece of this teaching. Another piece I think this brings in is when others end up suffering. There's kind of two parts to this. If there's not the intention, for instance, of causing harm, not a conscious intention of causing harm. In fact, it could be the opposite. It could be an intention towards giving somebody something nice. You know, it could be that intention. And yet, we may see suffering results. So there's two pieces to this. One is that, and I think this is where we often go, well, my intention was good, so, you know, it's their problem that they're reacting. And that can be, there is some truth there that, you know, no matter how open-hearted and generous and easeful we are, and the Buddha says, you know, people will blame you. You know, they'll blame you if you stay silent. They'll blame you if you speak short. They'll blame you if you speak long. It's like there's you know, people will be able to find fault, have reaction to however we are in the world. Partly because, you know, we're these bundles of causes and conditions walking through the world, and our causes and conditions meet. And, you know, some expression I have on my face may be an expression that somebody has an association with a parent that had been abusive to them, and poof, the reaction explodes. Not that I had any intention towards anything harmful. And so that can definitely be part of this reflection, to look, okay, you know, look into my heart. What was my intention? And to, you know, potentially recognize, you know, when somebody has suffered, it's like, wow, you know, I'm so sorry that that action caused suffering for you. Here's what was happening for me. That wasn't my intention. So that's part of this exploration, is to recognize that all the causes and conditions of the multiple beings in this world will interact in unpredictable ways. And there is also the possibility, and this is where I think it's really important for us to look, even when our intentions are good, seem to be good, if there is suffering in the world, is there something we need to learn? Is there something we didn't know that might inform our opening of our heart? Essentially, is there some delusion in our minds that even though we had this intention of goodwill, it's obscured by maybe a little bit of, like, for instance, in the act of generosity, you know, oh, I want to give this person this thing or something. And so there's that feeling of wanting to offer something. And, you know, maybe it's offering somebody help when actually they didn't want the help. Or they wanted to figure it out for themselves, or, you know, so that offering of, you know, well, here, let me do that for you, actually is creating some stress for them. So perhaps part of the struggle here, or part of the delusion might be, it's uncomfortable for you to sit and watch other people struggle, when actually they're okay in their struggle. So that may be a little bit of delusion that's masking that is kind of underlying, not seen behind that wish of providing support or help. There's a story I saw on This American Life. Some of you might be familiar with that. This was when it was on television. It was on for a couple seasons. And the story was the story was about a group called Improv Everywhere, which did these kind of performance art pieces in public. They would do things like, you know, in a subway car, pick somebody and celebrate, you know, a birthday, and have given out, you know, hats and blowers, and have everybody in the subway car singing happy birthday. So that kind of thing. Or another one was at night, there was in a city, there was a Whole Foods, I think it was, well, I shouldn't say it was Whole Foods, it was some building where all the windows were lit up, and you know, people see that there are these black figures that start to gather in the windows, one in each window. And, you know, the people on the street may, you know, just began to notice, oh, something odd is happening up there, and they start looking up, and there are these figures, one kind of right in the middle of each window of a whole building, and then suddenly they all start doing jumping jacks. So this is the kind of thing that this group did, this kind of public art. And then they decided to they called it the best gig ever, was the title of this performance piece. And it was their intention, or what they said, was they wanted to find a small little obscure band and give them the best gig of their life. Give them the best night of their life. And so they found an obscure little band. They were performing in New York City one night. And so they, you know, 50 or so of these artists, these performance artists, descended on the club that night. And, you know, they had prepared. They had... each person had studied the music of this group and learned the lyrics of the songs and clearly, you know, knew the songs. And so the night of that gig, people were, you know, Some people were like swaying with their eyes closed and mouthing the words of the lyrics, and some people were just like really, you know, dancing along. And the band, like, this was fantastic. It was the best gig that they'd ever had. You know, it's clearly, you know, they felt like, wow, this is so great. And you know, they left. They went back to their home, which was, I don't know, I think it was in Canada or something, I can't remember. And the improv group posted this, their public group, they posted this on their website. And it, months later, got back to this band that night had been a performance piece. And because of this event, people started, you know, listening to the music of these people and really trashing the band. And so there was a lot of harm created, a lot of suffering. In fact, they were kind of devastated. The band was kind of devastated, not only to learn it hadn't been true, but by the kind of internet fallout of this situation. And they interviewed the person who was the head of the improv group, Improv Everywhere. And he said, you know, our intentions were good. And he didn't go further. I didn't feel like he went further to look at, you know, there was suffering created there. Is there something I didn't look at? Is there something I didn't know? And in the other kinds of situations, there's a couple pieces that I thought of almost immediately, or one piece I thought of immediately, another piece a friend said right away, it's like the whole thing was based on a lie. You know, so right there, it wasn't based on genuinely liking the music that they were in that. It was based on a lie. And so that's one piece. So even wholesome intention or beautiful wishing to give somebody something, if it's based on something unwholesome, can have consequences. So that's one piece. The other piece that I thought of was, you know, this performance piece was kind of targeted. You know, the others were kind of like whoever happened to be on the subway car, whoever happened to be walking on the street outside the Whole Foods or the office building, they were the ones that got to participate or saw how this happened. But apparently, you know, there were maybe only three or four other people. There were 50 actors in that club that night and three or four other people. And so it was pretty much a private performance piece. So it was, you know, in a way, I mean, the best gig ever was intending to give something to somebody. So it was very targeted. It was a targeted kind of performance art. It wasn't kind of who's in the field. It was a targeted kind of thing. And that's partly what occurred to me. Maybe they could learn is that this kind of performance art maybe shouldn't be targeted to specific people. So, you know, when we find that suffering has happened, to use it as reflection, as the Buddha talked about, you know, how has harm been created? Is there something I need to learn here? To not just simply let ourselves kind of console ourselves, oh, my intentions were good, but to think, reflect, what did I need to learn? What might be something to learn from that situation? So, I've talked long enough. What are your thoughts? And let's use the mic.
Well, it's a last comment on the you cause suffering, but if you don't know, I just got an email from a friend that just mad at me, and I asked for forgiveness, but I didn't know what I did. So she wouldn't let me know, and I said, please, and my dad just passed away, so she responded very positive about condolences and about my father passed away last week. And so I have opportunity to write her and say, I haven't heard from you, and all my email bounced back, and therefore I will come to Hawaii, and would you like to see me? And so please forgive so that we can both have a better start, because I didn't know what I did. Mm-hmm. And this has been going on for a couple of years, and in my mind I still don't know what have caused it, and so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes we don't. And so, I mean, a couple pieces there in what you said. One, you know, that there, it may just be that you have to just keep the line of communication open to the point where the person is willing to say what happened. And again, you know, so just it's the part of the whole practice around our relationships is to see, can we keep an open heart to people? Even when there's contraction on the other side, you know, can we, you know, keep an open heart? And we won't always be able to. We'll close around. The other piece that I just heard, and I don't know if this is actually how you said it to the person, but you said, please forgive. And another way to phrase that, and see if this lands differently for you, I ask for your forgiveness. It's rather than ask, you know, it's rather than almost saying, you know, this is something you need to do, you know, please forgive me. I apologize for however I've caused harm. I hope that you can forgive me, or, you know, I ask for your forgiveness. So that's just one piece that I heard that can have a subtle impact on how people relate. And sometimes, you know, people don't understand in a way. I think sometimes people don't understand that, you know, there's it's so clear in their minds what happened. It's like, it should be obvious to them too, but, you know, so partly we can use it as a learning, you know, around seeing when we find something that we get angry or confused or frustrated about with somebody else's action, remembering they may have no idea either, you know, so to use it as a learning, a back and forth learning. And, you know, I think in your case it sounds really just trying to keep an open heart. Trying to keep that open heart. And I hope that there can be some communication between you around that.
I was just going to follow up on what you were saying. I think there is a dynamic element to this increasing self-awareness and then the increasing self-reflection as well, too. They go hand in hand. And your intention, I think, is very important. Initially, in terms of out of goodness that you're trying to do something, but in that you may cause harm, and you have to reflect on that.
Yes.
But there also is an element of the greater good. So if you see somebody doing true ignorance, something that's causing a lot of harm to other people, and you bring it to their attention, they may get offended.
Yes.
And so, and you may say, well, I was trying to help the greater good, and you might have to dial it back because this person may not be ready to
yes.
receive that knowledge that you are,
yes.
that you can see. So it's a constant tug of war between, you know, you seeing something, you're trying to change it, and then realizing this individual isn't ready, so I have to back off.
Yes.
And just being able to sit with that suffering that they may be causing. So It's a constant, you know, circle.
A constant
feedback, both of your own self-awareness that your action, even though it's pure, may actually be causing disharmony in that third person, and they
yes.
may be very uncomfortable, and you have to say, well, maybe they're not ready, and I have to stand back and do it. So there's, I just want to kind of
yeah,
reemphasize
absolutely.
That, you know, the, you know, where you were talking earlier about the acrobats, I think both were right. Exactly.
Yes.
There are two different ways.
Yes.
But in helping others, one could argue, in helping others, one realizes that one needs to help oneself in order to help others.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, whether it starts externally or internally, they kind of are both.
They do. They do feed back to each other.
Beautiful.
And the other piece, you know, the Buddha didn't say we should never do something that might cause distress in others.
Right.
You know, he actually, in looking at his own speech, he said, I speak what is true, what is useful, and in a timely way. But he didn't say, I try not to make other people feel uncomfortable. Because, in fact, a lot of what he said did make people feel uncomfortable.
But it does. We do need to be that prophet. We do need to say the uncomfortable things, because there will be some that will awaken and hear, that's what I need to do. Others will condemn you and stone you.
And
whatever.
And your point about... you know, people maybe not ready to hear. He brought that in too. It's like, yeah, sometimes you have to choose your time.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's learning how to do that. Thank you.
So thank you. We need to stop. And I'll be away for the next 6 weeks. I'm going to Insight Meditation Society to teach the retreat at IMS. And for the next 4 weeks, Robert Cusick will be here in the morning. So there'll be some consistency of teacher. And then the following 2 weeks, I can't remember who I've asked to teach, but there will be, of course, this group continuing. So I'll see you in 7 weeks, some of you at least.